right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again, and Dom, a few weeks ago, not exactly sure on the specific timeline, but very recently, we did a podcast talking about true crime, and that was a lot of fun, and today, we're back to talk a bit more about another kind of recent documentary phenomenon, and not so recent, just kind of social, cultural phenomenon, cults. First and foremost, how are you doing? I guess we should get a couple of things out of the way before we just dive into the really heavy hitting stuff. Are you feeling good today?
Well, funny you should ask. I've just left a cult, and I'm doing okay. Excited to be in here talking about this. This actually came about because, not because of our usual desperate scrabble for topics, but because when I watched The Vow a few months ago, I was really excited to do an episode on that and was asking around if anyone wanted to podcast with me about it. Turned out no one did, so I had to put that one on the back burner for the time being. But when I revived the idea of just doing this topic, I thought, well, why stop there? You know, why not cover cults as a whole? And there is absolutely no shortage of good documentaries and other media to sink your teeth into regarding cults. So very easy to get lost in the those rabbit holes, and we can dive down some of those ourselves in this episode.
Yeah, so I think to put a couple specific ones out there on the table and simultaneously issue at least a light spoiler warning on these specific documentaries. So if you've been like meaning to watch them for a while, there may be some details that come up along the way, but I would recommend, if people are interested in this sort of thing, some docs from recent years that I have seen and enjoyed, along this kind of subject matter are, as you alluded to, The Vow, or I guess explicitly mentioned The Vow on HBO. Also, Wild Wild Country was popular a year or two ago. I'm honestly not really clear on the exact timeline now, that time is so impossible to track these days. That was over on Netflix. And then I also watched Bikram on Netflix. I'm not sure if that was a Netflix original or what, but I think that also could fall under this umbrella. And potentially another one that is less explicitly about a cult, but I do think there could be some tie-ins. A very recent HBO documentary called Q Into the Storm, talking about the whole QAnon movement, for lack of a better word, at this particular juncture.
The better word may in fact be cult.
Yes, all of those I could see coming up and having some specifics mentioned, but I think most people would be fine carrying on without having seen all of those necessarily, or any of those necessarily. But what, not only are cult documentaries becoming a pretty popular thing, and I think for reasons similar to the ones that we laid out in that recent true crime podcast, it is a compelling topic for people just in general who are totally on the outside of any kind of cult-like activity. It's interesting to just see that this is something that is heavily prevalent, not just now, but throughout a long portion of human history, if not the entirety of human history. But Dom, my first question that I want to get into is the mere fact that so many cults have not only just existed, but really like taken off in popularity, and it seems like will probably continue to exist. I'm guessing there are plenty that are ongoing right now that we just don't hear much, if anything, about. More or less seems like pretty conclusive evidence to me that while to an outsider, it generally seems pretty crazy and impossible to kind of wrap our minds around how people get involved in this sort of thing in the first place, it's hard to disregard the fact that these are still, and potentially always have been, very popular, not very popular, but certainly things that exist pretty much constantly. And as far as I am concerned, as crazy as it may seem to us, it seems like there is something about cults that is on some sort of like fundamental level appealing to humans. What do you think it is that makes cults work in the first place?
Well, first of all, I think the word cult is obviously a heavily loaded designation. And that kind of goes both ways, because there are, I think, any following of any one person or belief system that acquires a sufficient intensity is going to be labeled a cult. It's very easy for it to get that label attached to it. But then also, there are many movements which I think could quite fairly be labeled cults, with all of the baggage that entails, that do their best to make it look like to the outside world that whatever they're doing, you know, whether it's some person who seems to have a surprisingly large and enthusiastic fan base, or some particular belief system which may have some wacky details to it, a lot of those people or organizations do everything they can to stop that label and its stigma from being attached to them. So, you know, it's tough to really be specific about what is a cult, who deserves to be labeled a cult, and you can go back and forth on that label as it applies to really anyone in particular. When it comes to, and I think that the topic of cults is one that certainly is fascinating for a Netflix style audience, right, where you could have an endless stream of documentaries made about cults, and it would never get old. I think that's a well that increasingly, as all other ideas for content are exhausted, that's something that they can keep coming back to time and time again. And there is some kind of explicit crossover with true crime. Like, many cults do end up devolving into just outright illegal activity of many sorts, but I think they do activate the same kind of interest in a lot of people, where it's that the whole idea of a cult is shrouded in mystery, and it's easy to sensationalize it. And for many of the things that get wrongly labeled as cults, you know, I'm sure there are people on the outside who look at those and think, oh, they must be some like crazy sex cult, or they must be involved in, I don't know, some weird religious practice or human trafficking or whatever. And actually, they're just a fairly mundane, if perhaps a little kooky, group of people minding their own business. On the other hand, you also have seemingly normal, you know, groups or people who, when you dig deep into it, some truly wild shit gets uncovered. And that's I guess that's the dream as a documentary filmmaker, right? Is you get the kind of first dibs on making some, well, what you think is going to be a fairly humdrum piece about some group. And it turns out that, you know, you lift up the stone and you uncover this whole world of just like dark, scary shit. And so, again, it's hard to, especially from the outside, before all of that happens, to look at any group and think, oh, and actually have a good measure of what's going on there.
Yeah, and I have pulled up something I probably should have looked into prior to coming on air for this podcast. I have just Googled the word cult, and the at least top Google definition is a system of religious veneration and devoted direction toward a particular figure or object, or a relatively small group of people having religious beliefs or practices regarded by others as strange or sinister. And then secondarily, in modern English, a cult is a social group that is defined by its unusual religious, spiritual, or philosophical beliefs, or by its common interest in a particular personality, object, or goal. And as we all know, any good speech or research paper begins with the dictionary definition of something. So glad we have checked that one off the box there. But yeah, I think it is probably extremely rare that anyone is ever saying to themselves, oh, I'm going to join this cult, or I'm in a cult, or whatever. I think it is, as you flagged up, a deeply loaded term that is almost exclusively used by outsiders. But setting aside what does or does not constitute a cult, I think most people have a general sense of what we're getting at. And as far as why cults, which seem outright crazy, I think, to most people on the outside of them, have a pretty long and storied history of being, I'm reluctant to use the word successful in human history, but at least consistently occurring throughout human history, is, as far as I'm concerned, the fact that people, and not just those who find themselves in cults, but people in general, I feel like, have a very innate and like deep-seated desire to have some sort of significance or purpose and hope for the future. And the community element, I also think, is a major factor there as far as being surrounded by other like-minded people. And one way or another, whatever the individual involved in whatever you want to classify the group as may feel, I do think the things we conventionally regard as cults go a long way in offering that. And I don't, again, think that anyone is actively saying to themselves, I'm going to join a cult now. I think they begin making some slight kind of leaps of faith, and after a certain amount of time, it just kind of snowballs on itself. And often the leaders of these movements get greedy is certainly the wrong word, but drunk with power, and it escalates very, very quickly. But I want to begin by saying, I actually think this is something that could happen to a lot of different people at a lot of different points in their lives. And I by no means think that every single person who's ever joined a cult has necessarily been just like completely off their rocker. I think it has been often is at least a very, very kind of gradual process. And before they know it, they're poisoning a whole town or whatever the situation may be. But it, I think, is a lot more, frankly, understandable than the kind of loaded term of a cult would lead an outsider to believe when they're just seeing the end result of how things ultimately play out.
I do think there are people out there who explicitly go looking for something to completely devote themselves to, regardless of how much sense it might make. They just want to be a part of something larger than themselves and something that is all-consuming and kind of explains not just one specific thing with its own boundaries, but the entire universe, yeah, their entire life. They want to commit to something. And one good example of this might be Mark Vicente, who, if you have watched The Vow or really anything in the extended cinematic universe of The Vow, because not only do we have The Vow, but in the case of that documentary, or rather docuseries, as is now the trend, that left so much out and it spent so long to convey absolutely nothing that people were hooked in by the kernel of the story that was bizarre and enraging and fascinating there, but they wanted to hear more about it. And so a whole kind of family of media documentaries, podcast series about Nixxiom and DAST and so on sprang up. And so you can really go deep in the weeds on that, and that can be a big time sink.
What are the other ones, just quickly, for both my information and for the audience's information?
What's that?
What are the other Nixxiom documentaries or podcasts or whatever that you would recommend?
So there's a podcast series that the CBC did here in Canada called, it's under the umbrella of Uncover, and it's just called Escaping Nixxiom. So it shouldn't be too hard to find that. And then there's also, I don't know what the exact name is, I'll Google that now, but India Oxenberg, who shows up in The Vow from time to time, she gets her own documentary about how she was hooked in and how she eventually escaped. And it looks like that's called Seduced: Inside the Nixxiom Cult. And so that really focuses on her story. But the specific character of Mark Vicente is someone who I want to highlight here, because I find myself enraged whenever he's on screen, kind of you wonder how someone who seems so hapless and bumbling and naive could just ooze his way to the top of this incredibly exploitative organization. And it turns out that he has form in this regard, where if you remember this documentary, there was all the craze in the mid-2000s called What the Bleep Do We Know? It's like massively popular, viral pseudoscience effort. He was at the heart of that. And so he really strikes me as someone who, you know, he goes from one kind of pseudoscientific scam to the next thing, seemingly without learning anything in between any of these points. And you wonder how much of it is conscious, you know, whether he, that this is all a grift to him, and once one thing has dried up, he moves on to the next one, or if he is the kind of lost soul that he either comes across as or portrays himself as in The Vow, where it's, he seems so kind of pathetic, and it's like he just wants someone to hold him and tell him that it's going to be okay. And whether that's some weird metaphysical theory about how the universe operates, or it's Keith Raniere and whatever is meant to be inspiring or comforting about him, he just wants to be part of something bigger. And I do think there are a lot of people like that. But as you say, it's easy to write off anyone who ends up in a cult as, oh, they're just some hapless rube, and surely I would never be susceptible to that. But for many of these cults, once they get large enough, then maybe this is my optimism about human nature shining through, although that's not really something I
yeah, noted optimist Dom Harvey.
I feel like there aren't that many total crazies to be swindled and to be taken in. And once you get several layers down in the pyramid, and each person has to keep bringing in more people for the whole thing to remain upright, eventually, yeah, you do crack into the deep well of normies out there in the world, the people who, for the most part, are normal and sane and well-adjusted people, but maybe have some personality quirk or even flaw, or just some life circumstance that makes them susceptible to this, if only for a brief moment. And what makes these cults so effective is that once they hook you in, like once you get your foot in the door, you know, they love bomb you. They give you the hard sell without you even realizing it. And they give you the sense of belonging and certainty and comfort that you really don't get anywhere else. And just a small taste of that can be totally intoxicating. And so once you get in, it's often very difficult to get out. And even if the scales drop eventually, whether it's because you have some personal epiphany, or the cult gets rumbled from the outside, or there's one event or moment that really brings the whole thing into perspective, at that point, it's so easy to rationalize everything that has happened, or which you maybe have been involved in yourself, because you don't want to go back to that state of kind of uncertainty and alienation and whatever that you had beforehand.
Oh yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with people landing on the conclusion that they want to reach, and then whatever is put in front of them, they will talk themselves into like reverse engineering how that all makes sense. And as far as like Nexium and Mark go, I do think it is worth noting that like in that particular case, they had a, at least compared to other cults that one might imagine, a particularly successful time kind of targeting and appealing to people who were already like kind of at least successful in real life. And a key element there may be Mark, and also I think Sarah, who was another prominent feature in this documentary, went a long way in framing it to newcomers as, yeah, I used to think this was crazy too. I went to my first seminar and I couldn't believe what I was seeing, but little by little it started making sense. And I do wonder how prevalent that may be as well. Like I said earlier, I think the kind of snowball effect is one of the more underrated elements in how cults both begin and continue to grow. Is it's not all presented at once as this kind of totally abnormal thing. It starts with, oh, this person's wearing a ribbon around their neck, that's kind of weird, and then a year later you're getting branded and doing human trafficking and all. I think that is a major element at play there. But I also wonder, because not only Mark Vicente being someone who seems to kind of at least potentially wander from place to place looking for significance or the next big breakthrough or whatever, but in Keith, the Nexium leader, in his own background, it seems like he also had a history of wandering from place to place or technology to technology or whatever the case was, of wanting to be the guy at the top of the pyramid on whatever the next big thing was going to be, and kind of some trial and error may have gone into getting all of this lined up and finding the marks of the world who are looking to answer to that sort of person. Do you think the average eventual cult leader is going into it saying to themselves, I knowingly want to dupe a bunch of people and essentially form a cult? Or in their minds, is this something that is a legitimately noble kind of pursuit that just gets out of control once they recognize what kind of command they have over people?
I do think many of them get wrapped up in their own mythology and do come to believe some of the things that they at first are forced to propagate about themselves just to keep people in and keep them mystified and elevate themselves in the eyes of others. And then, yeah, I think they come to believe some part of that themselves. I think it can only go so far as a grift, because it feels, and maybe this is me not being able to relate to that impulse, but it seems so wild to me that someone would go, yeah, I firstly should just try and get all of these people under my spell, and secondly, that I can do that. I can convince these people that I am the Messiah, or I do have, of all the billions of people out there in the world, I, you know, Keith Raniere, you know, some like dweeb who's obsessed with volleyball, like I have unique insight into how the world works, and people should listen to me. And I guess it makes sense if the cult has a more explicitly religious overtone, as many of them do, whereas, you know, if we follow this person and follow this religious practice, then we will attain salvation. I mean, that is something which, you know, billions of people across the world buy into to some degree or another. But very easy and very convenient as well that, oh, it just so happens that I, Colin Soane, happen to be the Messiah. Well, thank God it's me, not anyone else, right? Like, I think you would make a very effective cult leader, by the way.
Oh, I don't think so at all. I think...
You'd have to put your mind into it. I think it's a lot of legwork, but I think you have the talent. I think you can make it work.
I think one of the keys to this is people not feeling like they're being sold on that explicit concept. And I think I have a tendency to be a bit heavy-handed in trying to convey the points that I'm trying to convey. So I don't know that I would necessarily be a great kind of cult leader figure, although maybe I could find myself fitting squarely into like the Mark Vicente or whatever, sorry for not knowing his last name, role there. And I will acknowledge that, like, as I was watching The Vow, and frankly, like, as I was watching Wild Wild Country, which, you know, has vastly predated me even being alive, I did think to myself, like, I could see a younger version of Colin Soane buying into this sort of thing, not being the leader of it, but seeing some sort of appeal in what these people are talking about. And I do think it is an interesting element that, at least in a couple of these instances that we're going to be talking about more specifically, like the Bhagwan in Wild Wild Country, or like Bikram himself in the Bikram Yoga documentary, I think they legitimately began like believing I'm truly helping people, and found themselves surrounded by others who felt the same way and felt very strongly about that. And it, I don't think in virtually any of these cases was intended to become what it ultimately became. It was just once they started believing their own hype that it got totally out of control.
I do think that there is an element to having to believe it for it to be effective, where for many people they do have this bullshit radar to being sold something, and if it is a grift, then maybe some part of it comes across that way. Whereas if you believe it yourself and that's what you're selling, then people want to believe in things, and they want to believe that you believe, and so you can, it's almost easier to create this shared bond over, you know, if I tell you I'm the Messiah, in some ways that's easier to believe and comes across as more authentic than if I clearly don't have much self-confidence, but I'm trying to convince you that I think I'm the Messiah, where, you know, it comes across as disingenuous. So, yeah, I do think you do have to buy into your own bullshit to some degree to make it work. And I do always wonder what the backstory of many of these eventual cult leaders is, where you have to think for many of them, they don't end up, I guess, as you say, success is kind of the wrong word here, but they don't end up at the head of a cult on their first try, right? They probably have bounced from place to place, from grift to grift, until they find something that finally sticks. And there must be a lot of failed cult leaders out there who try and maybe try and emulate leaders that they've heard about in the past, and whether through just like a lack of personal charisma or you know, whatever else, they can't make it work. And yet I don't know what they do with their lives after that. Do they go back and find some office job, or is there something about these people where they are not wired to mesh with regular society in quite the same way, and so they will always be just on the outer orbit, on the fringes, finding some weird thing to occupy themselves with, even if they themselves are not at the center of it?
I would imagine that, for instance, like with Keith, if Nexium in particular had not panned out to the extent that he had hoped, but he had also managed to not go down like the explicitly criminal path at any point in there, he would probably be onto something else that would eventually snowball in that direction. But I think a big piece of it not only comes down to the figurehead believing their own bullshit, but having very vocal supporters who may even believe it more than they do, that are better suited potentially to sell newcomers on the idea that this person not necessarily is the Messiah, but at least has all the answers that you're looking for. So what is the second in command to Keith woman's name? The, like, I think somewhat successful businesswoman from The Vow who...
Nancy Salzman?
Yes. I think she was a vital role player in making that work. And similarly, Sheila, who was a real standout in Wild Wild Country, as far as I'm concerned, just an all-time, frankly, kind of standout in any documentary that I've seen, had a lot to do with making that work. And I think at a certain point, that becomes the bigger selling point for people getting in kind of on the ground floor, is how convinced those who have been around this person for a long time are versus how convinced this person, him or herself, is that they are the Messiah.
And that's something that struck me time and time again watching these documentaries, is that often the person at the center of it, the figure who everybody is meant to worship and believe in, seems so much less engaging and charismatic and believable than not just, you know, what you would expect in your head when going into it, you know, this person is a cult leader, but less of all of those things than other people in their own organization who are subordinate to them. And yeah, I think it, you know, it's no accident that for every Bhagwan, there's Amaran and Sheila, and for every Keith Raniere, there's a Nancy Salzman. But I found myself thinking, I want to see a documentary about Nancy Salzman, right? Like, I buy that she could rally all these people around her and be scarily effective at that. And she seems like the type who, yeah, and I think she did some of this work herself. She could be, she could crush it as like a corporate trainer, right? Or one of these like motivational speakers, or she could make an absolute killing on that circuit because she just is so wired to do that well. And likewise, if you want a documentary about Mara and Sheila, I have good news, Colin, because tomorrow, actually, as of the time of recording this, April 22nd, there is a documentary, Searching for Sheila, coming out on Netflix, I believe. So,
Hell yes.
Yeah, so I don't know if that's perfect timing or absolutely terrible timing to record this episode just before that's coming out, but a great companion piece to go and follow up on after you finish listening to this. But yeah, I found myself thinking, give me the Sheila documentary, give me the Nancy Salzman documentary. And in the case of Bikram Yoga, there wasn't one deputy in that case who I thought was especially compelling, but I found myself thinking, like, really, this is the guy? This is the best you could find as someone to invest all of your life's hopes and dreams into? You couldn't find someone a little bit more convincing or believable? But like, if I'm gonna go into a cult, at least make it someone who can rattle and dazzle you, right? As opposed to someone who honestly seems like one of those people who you would find ranting and raving at you on the street.
So I think in the case of Bikram, I at least personally, while I do not practice either of these things, I have very little doubt in my mind that both like yoga and meditation have immense practical benefits for people who are into it. And when you combine the kind of natural result of regularly practicing these sorts of things with the Bikram type, who I think I might slightly disagree with you on this one. Like, I think he is such kind of an oddball that when he's presenting it as, you know, these 27 poses are my thing that I came up with, even if that may not even necessarily be the case, and people are getting the results that they are in general kind of hoping for out of those practices, and seeing the guy at the head of this being such an oddball who's just wandering around in his Speedo and yelling at people and standing on whoever needs to be stood upon, I think they convince themselves that there's some kind of correlation between those two things. And, oh, because he's so eccentric, he must be the one who's on to this weird element that I have not been able to get out of whatever else I was into before, and are overlooking the just kind of natural benefits of yoga and meditation and assigning the value to the guy in the Speedo at the front of the class.
Yeah, I think there is a minimum level of deviance that any successful cult needs, where if it is just emulating things that people already believe in, if it's, well, people love meditation and yoga, so why don't we go into that ourselves and try and get a following? Well, then you're competing with all of the various meditation and yoga practitioners out there, many of which have actually maxed out their, you know, charisma stat or whatever more than you have. Whereas if you can sell yourself as being something quintessentially unique, where, yeah, it's, we're Bikram yoga and we have all of these distinct methods and rituals and processes, and often what you see is the cult has its own kind of dialect or language where there's all of this jargon and all of this stuff which is linked to that world that you need to know, and if, you know, once you get into the organization and people are doing these things and using these terms, you kind of want to be in on the joke and you want to know what they're talking about. And once you are there, once you are part of the inner circle, then that becomes a way to kind of signal that status that you are in on everything. And so you kind of almost have to go through all of those hoops or set up those hoops for other people to jump through in order for all of this to make sense and to keep people engaged.
Yeah. And to quickly return, I'm now very excited about the prospect of this Sheila documentary. She, as I said, was, again, I'm very reluctant to frame it in these terms for someone who is like explicitly, at least allegedly, kind of responsible for this mass murder, more or less, in the Pacific Northwest a few decades ago. But I think she was such a vital role player there, and hearing from her firsthand in that documentary was probably my favorite part. Like, as we talked about in the true crime podcast that we did, there are a lot of documentaries being done about people who are dead or in jail or whatever, but I think the, at least for me, the potentially most kind of compelling of that genre is what are essentially, although I don't know that they would be willing to admit this in such explicit terms, but like con artists more or less coming clean about this. And in her particular case, I do believe that she was initially just head over heels in love with the Bhagwan and wanted to promote his message as best she could, and at a certain point became just fully aware of what kind of influence they eventually had over people and what that made them capable of doing, and recognized that we could literally take over this small town in Oregon or Washington or wherever it was, and have all the seats on the city council and really make an entire movement out of this that could potentially sweep over a large chunk of real estate here. And that, to me, is really fascinating. And along similar lines, I think now that the QAnon movement, I'm hesitant to say this, but I hope, is kind of winding down, and the Watkins family has more or less kind of blown their cover there, I am very much looking forward to the eventual, okay, now we're willing to come clean kind of documentary. Whenever Ron Watkins decides that he wants more attention, I think that sort of thing could be potentially very compelling as well, because I do think these are the types of people who say this, who will eventually want the recognition for what they were able to pull off, and want to not necessarily be back in the headlines or whatever, but who want to explain like the master plan and how it all worked and how they were able to manipulate these people. And in both of those cases, and in many of the cases along similar lines, I want to reiterate, like, I don't know that they necessarily went in with any idea of what it would eventually become, but at a certain point just became aware of what they were capable of pulling off and just could not help themselves.
I think there was some talk, I recall, of Keith Raniere doing some kind of podcast or interview series or whatever from prison. And in one sense, that is a perspective you need to provide a proper look at the entire saga. At the same time, and this is the impulse that certainly went out for me, is just, I want the guy to shut up. I don't want to hear anything more from him. I don't want him to be given a platform again. And you know that you're not going to get any kind of actual honesty or reflection or anything. It's all going to be some more self-regarding bullshit. And why give him even more publicity, even more of the attention that he craves to spout all of that? So that's the issue with a lot of these documentaries, is that even if they purport to give some kind of objective look from the outside at what's going on, because that's mediated by who they get to talk to, and sometimes that is controlled by the organization themselves, or sometimes you just cannot find people who were high up enough in the organization to have a good sense of what was going on, or sometimes, and this is certainly the criticism that gets made of The Vow with both Mark Vicente and Sarah Edmondson, who she is the focus of the CBC podcast series, where it's hosted by someone who was a childhood friend of hers and ran into her after many years after she had left the cult, and he was somewhat surprised to learn that this seemingly normal person he knew from back in the day had joined this cult and then left and had this whole wild story. And as a journalist, naturally he wanted to dive deeper into that. But so often these series come across as like an apology tour, or a way to for certain people to excuse their own role in what happened there. And so, you know, with The Vow, that's definitely the case. And with Escaping Nexium, Sarah, I think, in many ways is one of the more sympathetic figures of The Vow, at least the ones that we have access to and who are the focus of the story. And yet it kind of implicitly glosses over the fact that she, as she admits, was one of the main recruiters for Nexium, right? She played as big a role as anyone, you know, maybe even bigger than Keith himself at one point, in driving people towards this organization. And I think that's a common thing you see when, once the cult reaches a certain size and importance, you cannot actually, as a single person, keep track of everything that's going on anymore. And so you see many of these leaders enter this kind of managerial role almost. They're like the distant CEO who has to delegate a lot of the responsibility to like the Nazi salesmen and so on of the world. And for that organization to keep growing, it relies on people on the ground who are very good at themselves being engaging and like proselytizing and convincing people to, oh, well, I know it sounds weird, but hey, it worked for me. Why don't you consider coming along to one of our meetings and seeing what you think with an open mind, knowing what that is likely to lead to? And, you know, obviously Keith is the biggest villain of that story, but I think an unsung villain, if you like, are the Sarah Edmondsons, who, you know, you watch Keith and you think, how can anyone be taken in by this guy? But you watch Sarah and you think, like, yeah, she actually seems like pretty normal, pretty relatable. You wouldn't think twice about being involved in something with her. And that's what's dangerous. That's what hooks you in, because, hey, if so many of these normal seeming people all buy into this, well, I'm a normal seeming person. Why shouldn't I buy into this too? And that's how you take the first step in this fatal direction.
I do agree with that, although I at least came away with the impression that in Sarah's case, as far as I could tell, and I could be dead wrong about this, but it did seem to me like she was trying to bring people in because she was a legitimate believer in, like, oh, this will change your life for the better. I don't think she was necessarily, at least, again, based on what I saw on that one HBO documentary, ever considering herself a, like, predator, maybe the wrong word or whatever, but anyone who was actively even necessarily lying about what she was saying, whereas I think Keith absolutely was. And to return to something you said earlier that I totally agree with, I don't know that Keith getting his own podcast from jail would necessarily be the move. I would be interested in hearing kind of his, if you were willing to give them, honest takes about how things went along the way. I just think that's a big if. I think if Keith got back in front of a microphone or Keith got out of jail, Keith would pretty quickly be back trying to start his next big movement and wrapping people up in whatever he felt like people would be likely to get wrapped up in. The same way, I think the guy's name was Peter Popoff, some sort of very prominent faith healer and televangelist from the 80s or 90s or whatever, who had this explicit scam. Like, he's the guy who would stand at the front of the church and put his hand on people's foreheads and miraculously know what kind of ailment they had. And he would allegedly, like, cure people who had to walk up to him with, like, a walker, and they could, you know, freely walk back to their seat or whatever. Yeah, it turned out a lot of them were actors, and he was wearing an earpiece, and his wife was in the back room telling him what people had written down as their problems on the cards ahead of time. And as soon as he was, like, back in the real world as a free guy, he is, I think, to this day, still scamming people now with, like, holy water. And I do think making, like, millions of dollars a year for people who just don't know what he was up to before. And that is, I think, probably the direction Keith would go. But Sarah in particular, I don't know if maybe I'm just grossly misinformed here, but I don't think I would consider her, like, a threat to fall into this same kind of behavior or mindset necessarily again. But is that something that you think is misguided, that Sarah was unfairly presented or views herself as kind of a victim here when she is largely someone that we should be holding accountable?
I think she can be both. And
to be clear, I definitely agree that she, sorry to cut you off immediately, but I totally agree that she was a vital role player in causing a lot of damage. I just got the sense, and again, it's only based on the vow, that it was completely unintentional, and she was being, as far as she was concerned, totally honest with people.
Yeah, I do think you can be both, and often people in the middle ranks of these organizations are, where they are being exploited by the people above them, but they are also enabling the exploitation of the people below them. So India Oxenberg, who was the subject of a documentary about Nixium herself, is a good example of this, where, yeah, she suffered horrific abuse at the hands of Keith and others, but she also had slaves herself within DOS. Like, she was someone who was, she was a cog in that system, and she went along with that. And, you know, that is as much a part of her record there as anything else. I don't think that people like that, once they have escaped, are going to be inevitably roped back into the next thing. But I do think that a, you know, it's difficult for anything which focuses on them and gives them a chance to tell their story not to fall prey to the kind of hagiography within that story as they're telling it.
Yeah.
And often people will kind of concede part of what they did, like, oh yeah, I was part of this, I was complicit, and then leave it there without really going into many more details. And so that partial admission gives cover to not have to talk about maybe the larger abuses that they actually did knowingly or, in air quotes, unknowingly participate in. I do also think that at some point you do have to take responsibility for being hoodwinked like that. I remember someone in the Bikram documentary saying that one reason they were taken in was he was just so kind to them. He enabled them to believe in themselves, and he was so supportive and uplifting and so on. And in the very same episode, you see someone else saying that in front of all of these people at one of these sessions, he would be like screaming at them, tearing them down, saying that, like, this is the reason that you're fat and no one likes you because you haven't figured out how to do this. And it's like, okay, I get that he makes you feel good about yourself, but if you see him mistreating other people in this way, surely at some point something has to click there, right? And it starts to look very myopic and selfish if, well, he makes me feel good about myself, so that's all I need. And you don't look at everything else that's going on there.
Speaking of, at some point it feels like something should click there, as you briefly touched on, but I thought probably should have been more of a tell for the Sarahs of the world, was the like slave and master relationship that people were eventually like involved in and like forced to be involved in and seemed to enjoy being involved in, as far as Nexium went, as that I felt like could have potentially been one aspect that should probably have raised a few more eyebrows than it seemed to. And similarly, the whole like collateral thing I thought was very weird and potentially should have had people asking more questions. But I do, to some extent, understand that it just started with, hey, it's kind of weird that these people are wearing these ribbons or whatever they are around their neck. And step by step, over whatever amount of time it ended up taking, like, I guess it just does seem less and less weird. And people are just conditioned to be involved in that sort of thing. But like, they had to send pictures of the food that they wanted to eat and like get permission to eat 300 calories worth of carrots and hummus or whatever. Like, I do understand, I think, roughly what you're getting at, that there probably should be a bit more accountability along the way in terms of, in retrospect, that maybe should have left me a bit more alarmed than it ended up leaving me. But one thing I want to just quickly return to is, it really does seem to me like, as outright crazy as all of this absolutely and justifiably, I think, seems to those of us not in the mix here, it does seem to have at least some sort of compelling effect on people from all sorts of walks of life. Like, with Nexium, we saw, I think, a pretty deliberate targeting of people who were generally pretty successful in their regular day-to-day lives, and in the case of Wild Wild Country, I think a very deliberate targeting of, we just want numbers, we will take literally anyone, bus in whoever we need to, we want as many people wearing the red and orange and purple as we can get so we can get more votes and make this seem like a bigger movement. And to make a potentially kind of uncomfortable survivor parallel here, but I think most people listening to this, is certainly at least 45 minutes into this podcast at this point, will roughly, hopefully, understand what I'm saying. Like, at the risk of saying anything libelous, and I don't think I necessarily am, like,
let's hear it. It
seems to me like Joe Anglim has fallen into something along these lines, and like, that is a guy who, at least on the surface, had pretty much everything anyone in the world could ask going for him this time 2 years ago. And it seems, based on social media stuff, and sorry if this is grossly misinformed, has just like completely fallen off the deep end. And that's one of the more interesting elements to me, is it's not just successful people. It's not just desperate people. It's not just poor people. And I think there is a tremendous amount of appeal for a lot of rich people who, it's particularly like generationally wealthy people, or like Allison Mack, who was a celebrity at a young age and then had a career kind of falling off, but like, who view themselves are just like wired to feel special since childhood and are manipulated into thinking that, oh, of course I would be someone who was brought into the inner circle and vaulted up to the top of the pyramid just because of my own things that I bring to the table rather than my checkbook. And Scientology, I think, has done a very good job kind of taking advantage of people in that sort of mindset as well. Like, I struggle to come up with a demographic that is not vulnerable to this sort of thing. And that is one of the more fascinating elements of all of this to me.
Yeah, I do think that the mark of a successful cult is knowing your mark, is knowing who the target audience is meant to be. And I don't know how much truth there is to this, but one theory I have is that cults that have a more explicitly religious bent tend to target people who are, you know, materially less well off, who are have a lot more suffering going on in their life, and that kind of like religious overtone is more appealing to those people, giving them a whole belief system that they can you know, commit themselves to, and that they can promise them some relief from the suffering they're going through in the world. Whereas the cults that seem to be more of a financial grift, these, you know, where it's kind of like a snake eating its own tail, where you have this system in place and then the system needs a constant stream of new money and new recruits to keep it going, then obviously then you have to target people who are wealthy. And that involves, it's either celebrities or it's successful professionals, it's people who maybe are going to live in wealthier areas. So like, it's no coincidence that there's a Nexium Center in Vancouver, for example, as opposed to, you know, somewhere in the middle of nowhere in Canada, or that you know, Scientology has gained so much of a following among the rich and famous because their wealth and their fame is what makes them appealing to Scientology as converts in the first place. And so yeah, I think that it's easy to talk about cults with a broad brush, but it's actually more interesting to get into the specifics and be quite granular about which kind of cult appeals to which type of person. And this is actually another aspect that gets glossed over in a lot of these cult documentaries, is that often, especially with a cult that has a global following or a following in a bunch of different places, focusing on one of those kind of obscures its appeal to other groups, or what makes it work elsewhere. So often the kind of in the finale, so to speak, of some docuseries about a cult, what will happen is they will lose a bunch of their closest followers, and then the whole system will come under more scrutiny, and there will be a bunch of stories in the media and so on. And so a lot of the less devoted followers, or the people who have just now had the scales drop from their eyes, will kind of slough off, and that leaves the people who, like, they're in now, and nothing's going to possibly get them out. And then the cult kind of relocates to a new place, but once it's there, it's gaining new converts all the time. You know, people who, I mean, I guess in some cases they can just Google these people and find out what's going on, but a lot of these cults have a surprising capacity for self-renewal. And so it's easy to look at a cult and say, all right, well, at least that's over with now. But often it isn't. Often that cult leader, despite having all of this information now about them in the open, they go back to just living their life as before, but just with a new cast of characters around them. And so it's easy to, in some cases, write off people who buy into a cult as, oh, well, this is just something for people with more money than sense and who don't know what to do with their time. And that very often is the case, but it also is going to attract a lot of people who are genuinely lost and who have reasons to be looking for something that they can put their faith in. And that's why I think that whatever demographic you're in or whatever background, there is an element of that that can make you susceptible to these kind of appeals where, yeah, if you are, if life has screwed you over, then you want something that is an escape from conventional society and offers you a way out, so to speak, and a cult can be that. At the same time, if you are the Joe Anglims of the world, if you have every benefit that life can possibly provide you, and yet you still feel this deep lack of satisfaction with where your life is going, then seemingly the only route to attain that is going to be something that exists outside the bounds of conventional society and morality. And, you know, that's where the cult steps into the picture.
Yes, and I now recognize, I said libelous earlier while we are speaking, so it's more slanderous that I am nervous about.
Oh, thank you. What a relief.
Yes, thankfully libel I feel pretty safe from here. I am totally with that. And as I said near the top of this podcast, I believe, like, watching a lot of these documentaries, it has definitely crossed my mind and been, like, borderline scary to me how, at least during, like, the introductory phases, and as we're hearing about how people got involved in the first place, like, how easily I could see myself or someone like me falling victim to this sort of thing. And another thing that scared me a bit is, in doing a bit more research and seeing how all how at least some of these have ultimately played out, I'm not exactly sure how to frame this. I framed it as, like, the cult leader getting greedy earlier, and I don't know that that's necessarily the right way of putting it, or, like, drunk with power or whatever, but it really does appear to me to be the case that had they just scaled back on the murder and human trafficking and sex crimes and all of these things, like, I feel like a lot of these could still be thriving today. And I was on Wikipedia just looking through famous, like, cults throughout history, and was blown away to find out that, like, David Koresh held power for a solid decade within the Branch Davidians there, or, like, Jim Jones was running his scheme, for lack of a better word, for 25 years before it all came kind of crumbling down. And, like, it seems like, to potentially use an example that will be lost on a lot of people, but there was recently a scandal in the world of poker where this guy, Mike Possel, as far as I am concerned, could quite clearly cheat by seeing the cards that the people he was playing against in real time were holding. Nothing has been proven conclusively, but, like, that is the only even slightly reasonable conclusion there. And, like, that has been a concern in the poker world, in the online world, and in the live streaming world now for a while. And one thing that I keep returning to is, like, someone who is cheating or conning people or running some sort of, you know, in the poker world or in the cult world, like, running some sort of operation like this, if they were just slightly smarter about it, they could have gotten away with this forever. Or, you know, slightly less criminal about it is probably a better way of framing that as far as a lot of these specific cult examples go. And that is something that both fascinates and terrifies me, is it feels like people with similar qualities and similar abilities to identify the targets that they want to go for, who just do so in a less criminal way, or a less overtly even criminal way, I feel like could have gotten away with this and potentially are still currently getting away with this virtually, like, indefinitely. And that
That's the thing, I think, is that documentaries don't get made about the cults that are just quietly ticking along in the background because they haven't flown too close to the sun yet. And often those groups don't get described as cults because that's what we call the ones who went down in flames. But they are their community groups, or their marketing organizations, or they have some incredibly generic title where from the outside they can maintain plausible deniability because they haven't done anything that's too completely overtly outrageous yet. And so, you know, you have people who have locked themselves into those, I think it's fair to call them cults, but who are, like, that there's no, I don't think there's any prospect of something happening to, like, jolt them out of that. And that's a scary thing, almost. It's that for every Keith Raniere, who it feels like it was only a matter of time before all of this came crashing down and highlighted all the pain that he had caused along the way. There are going to be people out there who maybe have not caused the same degree of pain, have not been like that deranged and that over the line, but who, you know, are a net drain on society, who are really at, you know, having a negative effect on the world, but just no one knows about them because they have had the good sense to keep their head down.
Right. And sorry to make such a like sketchy poker comparison with the whole Mike Postle situation, but like Mike Postle could have so easily gotten away with it if he were just less greedy, if he had occasionally just like deliberately misplayed a hand to cover his tracks, like he would still probably be getting away with it. And I'm guessing there are other people out there who are kind of in the poker world, like super users, who have been getting away with it because they're not so blatantly obvious about it. And I would imagine the same is true in the cult world as well. Dom, one question I've had is, I feel like most of the cult things that I have seen have been specific, for the most part, to America. And actually, before I ask this question, let me back up quickly and say, Bikram of Bikram Yoga is still getting away with it. Like, he's still just right now. He's just doing it in Mexico and Spain and wherever else these days because he has recognized that America is just too hot to keep going with this sort of thing. But like, he's still literally like practicing to this day and maintaining this whole thing, even despite this Netflix documentary being out about exactly what has been going on. But are cults like a prevalent thing in England other than the monarchy?
I knew this question was coming. I mean, I don't believe they are any more or any less prevalent in England than in any other places. I don't know why they would be or how I would possibly know that, but by all means, jump in and let me know.
Is there a David Koresh or a Jim Jones of England?
Unless I'm forgetting something, I don't think there has been a high-profile example of like a cult that originated and was contained to England. I think most of the ones that are popular there are ones that had some kind of like larger global presence. One thing that is worth tying into this discussion, though, is that they're not cults, but you might call them like multi-level marketing organizations or pyramid schemes or and there are technical definitions to all of these things, but I guess, what would you call them? Like movements, or I guess grifts is a fine like all-purpose designator. Sure. Here. Things which maybe they're not built around evangelizing one specific person, holding them up as some kind of messiah figure, but just whether it's some like product or some belief system or whatever it is, this self-perpetuating movement that has to keep dragging more and more people into its orbit, those are very popular and much more endemic than cults, where I think people are trained to recognize, hey, this guy who says he's a messiah, maybe he's not actually the messiah. But much more difficult to realize that someone who is selling you some like get rich quick investment scheme or some you know, that this hot new thing, which, hey, people in the industry don't want you to know about this, but get on in on the ground floor now and you too can be successful. Some would argue that stuff in the cryptocurrency space or NFTs maybe could fit that description. But there are so many things under that umbrella where I think some of these same behavioral patterns and some of the same kind of psychological motivators are at work there. And yet, because they don't have one person to fixate on and to assign the blame to, it's easy for those organizations to kind of work undercover, where even if there's some media spotlight on them, then who is it that's taking the fall, right? Because the whole point is that there's no one person who you can point to and say, oh yeah, it's their fault that Herbalife or whatever is so popular, right? It's so popular because so many people are going out there and recruiting so many more people who in turn and so on and so forth, and that's the way it works. It's like a distributed network that is not meant to have, it's horizontal, it's not meant to have any one person there.
Yeah, and I think you are right that there are a ton of seeds planted that takes similar forms between cults and like multi-level marketing things, and that is absolutely something that is currently happening in like the crypto and NFT space for sure, just like quick cash grabs. But I think there is a discernible difference, at least in my eyes, between a cult, I think, offering people essentially hope and answers to whatever burning questions they have about life and making them feel significant and like part of a community and so forth. And there is some tie in there, but I think with MLM and et cetera, a lot of it on that side is primarily financially motivated. And I do think that is kind of a different thing.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So what other points did we want to get to here today, Dom, as far as the cults of it all go?
I think that covers most of what I have. I don't know what it is that makes the idea of a cult so fascinating to me. And I'm a sucker for all of these documentaries, you know, even if it's kind of done in a misleading way, or clearly it's biased, or it's leaving a lot of stuff out, or even in the case where like the cult at the center of it is actually not that interesting or not that original, for some reason, just the basic premise still captivates me. So I am the easy mark in this case. You know, I am the person who will buy what they're selling unconditionally and lovingly. But I don't know why that is, but I don't see that changing anytime soon. So if any of you out there have recommendations for good cult documentaries, hit me up and make my day.
Absolutely. Dom, I'm very much looking forward to this upcoming Sheila doc that I did not know about, but am definitely going to be binge watching tomorrow, I guess, at the time of this recording. And potentially, actually, we could find ourselves in here talking about that too. And again, I'm reluctant to frame her in these terms based on, at the very least, the charges that have been lodged against her and potentially things she's even like admitted to doing in the past. But like, Ma'anad Sheila was the standout MVP for me in all of the cult docs that I have seen. So extremely excited to see what she's been up to lately. So I think that is going to basically wrap it up for us. Other than Dom, while we are here, would want to flag up for you, I do have some Berry Blast drinks that I feel like would be a great opportunity for you to get involved in if you wanted to use my code. That, all right, apparently not. So I think that's going to do it. Hilarious joke to close the podcast aside. Dom is, of course, on Twitter at DomHRV. I can be found at Colin Stone. And I believe this may not be the last time that we are in here talking about things along these lines. So subscribe if you would like more potentially cult-related things coming in the future. But generally speaking, we are talking mostly about reality TV for anyone who has found us through like the cult world and is randomly a Survivor fan. That is more or less what we are usually talking about here. And of course, bonus episodes every week over on the Patreon feed at patreon.com/Dom and Colin. Definitely not a cult going on over there. So that, I believe, is going to finally do it for us. We will talk to you guys soon. Take care, everybody.